Thank you, sir. Okay. Today's message is mistakes in being unleavened, or mistakes in being unleavened. I'm going to start this sermon in an odd way, a little bit of history, but it fits in. The King of England wanted to divorce his wife because he wanted a male heir. The Pope said, no, we're not going to allow you to divorce your wife. So the King of England said, I'm going to join the Protestant movement, create the Church of England, which he would be the head of, which technically that's still true to this day, or Queen Elizabeth is the head of the king, the Queen, the Church of England. He was head of the church, so of course he could divorce his wife. Actually got several new wives, but another story. But one of his advisors said, well, why should we have the Latin Bible in England? Let's get rid of it and let's put the Bible into English. Now, that's the real crux of the story. When he put the Bible into English, he unleashed a spiritual tsunami or spiritual avalanche. All of a sudden, people in England, but then other, because England had influenced other places as well, and later their colonies, started to pick up the Bible and say, wait a minute. What we see in the way of religious traditions don't match this book. And a new movement to purify religion came along. And, of course, we know it as the Puritan movement. And there's a whole lot to be said about that. And Oliver Cromwell, their general hero. But we won't get into all that. I want to get into the part that affects us. 103 of the Puritans, who were maybe the most pure as they saw it, of course, didn't like the religious freedom they were not getting in England. And they eventually, a little bit of stopover in Holland, but they went to the New World that was relatively empty to get their religious freedom. Now, they were supposed, the king had a fort in Jamestown, a little small fort in Virginia, and that's where they were supposed to go. But the autumn winds blew the ship off course, and they ended up in Plymouth Rock in what's now Massachusetts. And there was no government there. And the sailors said, this sea is too rough. We're lucky to get you here. We're not going back to Virginia. So they were stuck in Plymouth Rock, and there was a village cleared out. It's really a great story, how everything was ready for them. You know it was God's will. So their pastor said, well, let's form our own government. And then we got the Mayflower Compact, and believe me, they were very religious, very Old Testament religious, too. You read the things they put in there, very religious. Well, once they made a financial success of it, within a decade, about 30,000 other Puritans came to the New World. And among them, and I got this from a secular book, not from a church book, a number of Sabbath keepers came as well. And I was thinking about it. If you are the Church of God, wouldn't that be the place for religious freedom? Because in those days, even the Protestant movement had problems, like certain parts of Germany. If you were not a Lutheran, you suffered problems. And then we could rattle off some of the other groups that had their own little parts of countries. So that's actually true to the world is today to a great extent. And when America finally formed and put as the number one Bill of Rights, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of religion, it was unique in the world. Nobody in the world had ever done that. And it's still somewhat unique, actually, when you look, if you study it carefully. And it allowed the truth of the Bible to flourish in a way that nobody suspected. The King of England didn't certainly suspect that. And you could argue that putting the Bible into English was one of the first steps in creating the greatest nation in the world, the envy of the world. And even though we might have complaints about the U.S. economy now, I guarantee you, you pull a bunch of boats up, all kinds of countries all over the world, and say, get on this boat and you come to America, they'd fill that boat up so fast your head would spin, literally. And they're paying, I guess they call them coyotes, Mexican smugglers. They pay them a fair amount of money to smuggle them across the border. I mean, it's still the envy of the world. And it's because of the power of this book. When the regular people, because only the priest could read Latin, for the most part, really read it. It really changed the world. And one of the things that it's like the people escaped Europe to get away from paganism or paganized, compromised religion, where they could practice religion more purely, reminds me of the Israelites. By the way, when the Israelites left Egypt, they had the Passover lamb was killed. Within a few hours of killing that lamb, nightfall came and they ate the meal. And they, of course, were protected by the blood on the doorpost. Matter of fact, the other night, they put on Charlton Heston and the Ten Commandments on TV again. And every time you see it, you realize a couple more details that aren't quite purely biblical. But still, for Hollywood, that's a great movie. I mean, for Hollywood. And Yul Brynner was the greatest. He really was the Pharaoh. I mean, he played the role. But so the Israelites marshaled that night and started their movement. And then 7 days later, on the last day of unleavened bread, they crossed the Red Sea and left Egypt. So the last day of unleavened bread represents our leaving the land of sin and paganism forever. Because that's what Egypt represented. Slavery to sin, slavery to the Egyptians, and a very pagan religion. As a matter of fact, someone said this the other day. The most popular nightclub in Las Vegas is called the Ra. And it's under this Egyptian big pyramid. And you go underneath it, and apparently they have all the pagan gods of Egypt all over the walls. And then they have a weird light show where lights come out of the eyes of the pagan gods. It's real creepy, and it's kind of vampire, ghoulish, creepy. But people like that now. The most popular TV shows are The Living Dead. I hope I got that title right. About, they're not vampires. Mummies. No, not mummies. Zombies. But the same thing. Zombies, vampires are the most popular thing in nightclubs in Hollywood. You can see paganism is coming back. It's getting more popular. And Christianity is under greater criticism out in the public. Keep your Christianity to your churches and be quiet. Don't say anything that we don't think is politically correct while you're in those churches. So this day represents leaving sin behind, the last day of unleavened bread, just like the Puritans left. Now, Natalie got this book for me of a famous Puritan preacher, John Owens, way back in those days. But, you know, when you read their work, you realize that they really got into the Bible. Whatever you might think of the Puritans, they really changed things. And I think in some ways they made England greater, and they certainly had a lot to do with making America America. I mean, you could argue, well, some people would have come over here anyway, eventually. You know, you can always do that argument. But the ones who actually did come and did make this nation great were the Pilgrims, who also, they learned one lesson, too, that's worth knowing. They tried a communal thing the first 2 years. Poverty didn't work. You know, the free rider problem. Everybody had stuff in common. Once Governor Bradford said, we're going to go capitalism, every family will get certain tools and seeds, and then you will profit from whatever you develop. And if you don't develop anything, you're going to be in trouble. Well, obviously, productivity took off like a rocket, and America has been the premium country for capitalism ever since, as one president said, the business of America's business. And that, to some extent, we're not as capitalistic as we once were, but to some extent, it's still true. And America is still the center of world trade. It's still the greatest capitalist country in the world. Anyway, we want to get to the Bible. I want to go to 1 Corinthians 5, because we want to look at mistakes you can make in trying to be unleavened. And some of these come from the minds of the Puritan leaders. Obviously, I only pick out the stuff I agree with, but 1 Corinthians 5, verse 6. This is the Message Bible. So this Bible is a little bit different than what you're used to reading. So just keep that in mind. He says, your flip and callous arrogance to these things bothers me. You pass it off as a small thing, But anything but that, you know, a little leaven or yeast, you think it's a small thing, but a little leaven or a little yeast works its way through the whole batch of bread and pretty fast. And if you don't get rid of that little yeast, it'll ruin the entire loaf. Our true identity is flat and plain or unleavened, not puffed up or wrong of ingredients. And he talks about the Messiah as our Passover lamb. But a little leaven leavens the whole lump. That's kind of the phrase I want to focus on. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And let's say if you say to yourself, well, you know, I'm a pretty good person, and I go to church, and I give to the church, and I do some good stuff. But I have one sin. I know it's a real sin, but I don't want to give it up. I don't consider it that big a sin. I think that one sin God will understand, or I can say you can have excuses for, you know, all kinds of reasons. That is a bad strategy. That doesn't work. And I don't want to mention any specific sin. I've done that in the past. Somebody says, you're talking about me or you. You know, and I really don't know any of your secret sins. So if I say anything, it's purely, maybe it's God's spirit or coincidence, but you know, they got mad at me. But whatever it is, you think you can control it. You can keep it a little sin. You can think you can keep it off in the corner. Won't give you any trouble. But I believe Paul was right. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. It'll somehow crowd into your life more and more and push you into darkness, into sin, and further away from God. I'm not saying that weaknesses aren't a problem that will bounce back and back, but you have to keep fighting it. You can't just say, I'm going to accept it, and then whatever reasons you give for it, I believe it will not work. You cannot openly say to yourself, I'm going to allow this sin because it feels good. Or people in my family have always had this problem. And I mean, there are great and there are even better excuses than that. But you must fight it. You must ask God to control it. Go to Psalms 40, verse 12. Now, I'm reading a different translation than yours, so it will sound a little different, but I think the point will be about the same. This is the Message Bible. Psalms 40, 12 reads, when troubles ganged up on me, a mob of sins past counting, I was so swamped by guilt, I couldn't see my way clear. More guilt in my heart than hair on my head. So heavy the guilt that my heart gave out. I realize that's not exactly the way it's worded in the King James, but you can be swamped by the sin. If you play with it, toy with it for years and years, it can swamp you. And that's what is being written about in Psalms. Do not take a vacation from obeying God. Oh, I think I'll take a couple weeks off and kind of go with the world and be worldly. That is a mistake, taking a week off. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 4. These are mistakes that you could make. And 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16. 2 Corinthians 4, 16. So we're not giving up. How could we? Even though on the outside it often looks like things are falling apart on us, on the inside where God is making new life, not a day goes by without his unfolding grace. These are hard times. I mean, these hard times are small potatoes compared to the good things, the good times, the lavish celebration that's prepared for us. So Paul is saying, day by day, don't give up. There's a great celebration waiting for us if we hang in there. There's far more than meets the eye. These things we see now are here today, gone tomorrow. But the things we cannot see will last forever. There's a spiritual reward that lasts forever, but on a day-by-day basis, we have to keep fighting the good fight because we're renewed day by day. I think that's the key thing Paul is saying, renewed day by day. I'm not going to read 2 Peter 2:20, but he says you can be dragged down if you make a deal with sin in the evil world. That's in 2 Peter 2:20. But I want to go to John 15:5. John 15:5 reads, John 15:5, I am the vine, you are the branches. When you're joined with me and I with you, the relationship intimate and organic, the harvest is sure to be abundant. Separated, you can't produce a thing. Anyone who separates from me is dead wood, gathered up and thrown in the bonfire. So when I say don't take a vacation from, you know, obeying God, following God, you know, being a, you know, following, you know, the kind of things that, you know, a good member of the church should do, Christ is saying that we're like a little vine with a grape on it. You cut it off from the main branch, Jesus Christ, as he feeds us through the Holy Spirit, you're going to wither and die. We can't do it on our own. We have to stay connected. So if you disconnect yourself for a little while, you may wither and die. I mean, you may just dry up and, you know, you won't have any spiritual juice, if you like that terminology. We cannot do it on our own. We can only do it with God's help. We can only do it with God's help because human nature has this lower side and it's strong. What can we say? Another thing we could do wrong is don't get overconfident. Let's say you have 3 or 4 or 5 weeks where you are, at least as far as you know, being very good, very spiritual, bad thoughts kept at a bay. Everything is going well. And you think, well, I've beaten all my problems. I'm really clicking on all 8 cylinders. I'm a spiritual machine, a spiritual superstar. Don't get overconfident. I want to go to Revelation 3. I know it's a very, very familiar scripture, but I think this church is quintessential overconfident, and wrongly overconfident church in this case. Remember, in the context in which we mean it, you are not your judge. Christ is. You might think you're doing wonderful, and you get overconfident and relaxed. I got it made. I'm smooth sailing. Maybe you're not doing as fabulous as you thought you were. But but even if you are doing well, I want to say this. Even if you are doing well, remember, the lower side of human nature never disappears until it's taken away and we get a spiritual body and a spiritual mind and we're in God's family. As long as we're fleshly human, your human nature is down there deep inside like a cornered rat somewhere waiting to spring out at some untoward moment and say something, do something. Well, you know what I mean. So even if you really are doing well, still don't get overconfident. But you can also be overconfident. You think you're doing well, but God doesn't see this. I'm going to start in verse 14, Revelation 3. The message to the Laodicean church. One of the churches, Paul didn't start, but one of his disciples started. So Paul didn't know them by face. Write to the Laodicea, to the angel of the church, God, yes, the faithful and accurate witness, the first of God's creation, says, I know you inside and out and find little to my liking. So they think they're doing great, but God doesn't say that. You are not cold and you're not hot. Far better to be either cold or hot. In other words, to be not converted or a really strong Christian. You're stale or lukewarm. You're stagnant. You know, it doesn't sound that good. You're stagnant. You make me want to vomit. You brag. In other words, this is the Bible. This is Christ, you know, speaking to the leader of that church. You brag. I'm rich, meaning rich spiritually, of course. I've got it made. I have need of nothing from anyone. Notice, I don't need any help because we're like a 8-cylinder engine kicking on all cylinders. You know, anytime you think you have need of nothing, that's the time to worry. You need no improvements. I have need of nothing from anyone, oblivious that in fact you're pitiful, blind. And he means spiritually blind. You really can't see what's spiritually going on. Beggars, threadbare, he means in true godly righteousness, and homeless. Now, you know, that's a really overconfident church. We don't want to get overconfident thinking, man, I am really wonderful, great news, big deal. Let's go to 1 John 1, verse 8. 1 John 1, 8 says, 1 John 1, 8. if we claim that we have no, we're free from sin, or we have no sin, because we're really doing good, we're only fooling ourselves. That, this is a different translation, but it's the same meaning. We're fooling ourselves. A claim like that is arrant nonsense. On the other hand, if we admit our sins, make a clean breast of them, he won't let us down. He'll be true to himself. In other words, what he's saying is human nature always has some sin element in there. You're never as good as you think you are. You always have to worry about the potential for sin. And maybe we are winning, and that's good if you're winning. But even still, don't dismiss human nature. So like a team that goes into the play, an underdog team, oh, that team is weak. We got nothing to worry about. That's the team that's likely to get upset. You know, you think you've got your human nature under control, but you just never know. We'll never be perfect from sin. I want to throw in this corny joke. It's called Morning Health Check. Nurse, good morning, Mr. Frobisher. You seem to be coughing much more easily this morning, Mr. Frobisher. That's because I've been practicing all night long. Well, you get what you practice. So if we practice good stuff, we get better. If we practice sin, we'll get worse. But I believe you can never totally root out the depth of evil. And by the way, the Puritans really taught that kind of stuff. They really worked on purity, or at least that was a focus that they made. Let's say if you make excuses for yourself. That's another mistake. By the way, there are really some good excuses. Now think about it. Depending on the problem you have, you could say it's, I inherited the potential weakness. And there are studies that show certain people have a greater weakness for certain problems than others with a different background. You can blame it on your crazy uncle. When I was an impressionable kid, 12 and 13, my uncle, and then you can talk about stuff you did with your uncle that was bad. And by all of that's very true. Or my older brother. Or my parents. And boy, are there all kinds of bad parent stories that we could get into. Or you could talk about the other kids in the neighborhood. Or the school system. Or the movies. I could probably come up with a couple other really great excuses. And those excuses might, or grandparents were bad influences. Or the power of the drugs just got me. Somebody was talking about Prince the other day. I said, what's the big deal? It's just another rock and roll star swept up by drugs. It killed most of them. I mean, you know, it was all, to be a musician at least certain point in time, this lady whose son is a musician, and I won't go into detail, we were talking, and she was hoping her son doesn't get into drugs because that is the big threat. I don't know how it works, but I guess backstage, their fans bring them drugs or whatever it is. But and that would be a good excuse. I'm a drug addict because the people who like me keep offering me drugs at parties that I go to. And the excuse would be a true one, but it still doesn't change your guilt. And by the way, I believe God knows he did not pick the greatest or mightiest people. And he knows that we've been grown up in a world full of bad influences. So I'm not saying God doesn't understand. He does. But he still expects us to overcome, to use his spirit to overcome. So don't let all your bad uncles and other bad influences as your excuse, because even if the excuse is true, I'm under bad influences. That's the world we live in. Everybody's under some level of bad influences, some worse than others, I'll admit. We all have obstacles to achieve and to overcome. Let's go to James 1. And we got James 1, verse 13. James 1, 13. James says, don't let anyone under pressure give in to evil. Say, God is trying to trip me up. In other words, the only reason I gave in to evil is because God put all those obstacles in my way. Or some variation of that. God is impervious to evil and puts evil in no one's way. The temptations to give in to evil comes from us and only us. In other words, The evils may be there, but there's something deep inside us that evil was able to appeal to that we have to repent of. So even, I don't blame God. He put me in a bad world. Well, that part is true, but it's something in us that responds like resonating sounds. We resonate the evil. So when your uncle brought you some bad influences, you had that same evil in you that resonated with your uncle's evil, and whatever happened. Because that is human nature. It's our fault. Verse 17, he's speaking about God's gifts. The gifts are rivers of light cascading down from the Father of light. There's nothing deceitful in God, nothing two-faced, nothing fickle. He brought us to life using the true word, showing us off as the crown of all creatures. So God is blessing us with the true word. And when the King of England put this book in common man's English, he unleashed something that was good for the Church of God and is good for us individuals. And it really did change the world. It's kind of amazing that one decision when his advisor says, get rid of the Latin Bibles, let's have some English Bibles. And whoa, what a difference that made in the world. And it helped create the land of religious freedom, the United States of America. By the way, even that storm that blew them off course, you know that was God's will, don't you? For them to land at Plymouth Rock and have to form their own government and get used to governing themselves. We all know that was not an accident. You just know that. God was in charge of that whole process. verse 19. Post this at all the intersections, dear friends. Read with your ears. Follow up with your tongue. Let your anger straggle along in the rear. In other words, don't get angry. God's righteousness doesn't grow from human anger. So anytime you get angry, you're like opening a door for Satan, and don't do it. So throw all spoiled virtue and cancerous evil in the garbage. In simple humility, let our gardener, God, landscape you with the word. Isn't that a beautiful way of expressing it? Landscape you with the word, you know, with the Bible. So when the king opened the Bible into English, he really did change the world. Now, he didn't plan all that because it gave him trouble trying to run the Church of England. But, who knew how God would use that? Making a salvation garden of your life. So we should be gardening our mind and life. Verse 22 and 23. Don't fool yourselves into thinking that you are a listener when you are anything but. Letting the word go in one ear and out the other. Act. A-C-T. Act or do. Be a doer. Act on what you hear. Those who hear and don't act are like those who glance in the mirror and walk away 2 minutes later with no idea what they are, what they look like. In other words, listen to the word and act on it, obey it, follow it. Make no excuses, though there are plenty of legitimate excuses you could make. Why didn't God put me in a better family or a better neighborhood or whatever you want to say? Romans 6, and there are probably a lot of people who have some really bad stories they could tell you about their relatives and friends and neighbors. And Romans 6, Romans 6. Could it be any clearer? Our old life was nailed to the cross with Christ, a divisive end to that sin miserable life, no longer at sin's every beck and call. Remember, by the way, the definition of sin, 1 John 3:4, is the breaking of the law. Now, a lot of the world doesn't know that. They think sin may be dancing too much. Some people play cards too much. Smoking too much. Actually, the definition of sin is breaking the law. And the Ten Commandments are the core, of course. No longer at sin's beck and call. What we believe is this. If we get included in Christ's sin-conquering death, we also get included in his life-saving resurrection. And he says in Romans 6, 1 and 2 that, does grace and faith undermine the law? Heaven forbid. So this is not against God's law. It's actually going along with God's law. Just in a final statement, I think God blessed the world by putting the Bible in the common language. By the way, and then Europe, Tyndale and others got it into the German language and the French language and, you know, and other languages. But it had its greatest effect on England and what became the English Empire. And I tell you what, one of the most interesting things, I know this, I'm going to one more chapter of the story about England. When the King of England left, the King of Spain, because Spain was now building a big empire and getting rich off of the New World, you know, they had a big empire in South America. But the King of Spain was also the King of Austria and the kind of the warrior prince of the Holy Roman Empire. So the Pope assigned him to punish the British. And they sent this, and they used their money to build this super fleet, this armada of unbelievably big warships to go to Britain and conquer Britain and teach them a lesson. You read the story of what happened to that armada, and you have to see the finger of God. All kinds of weathers and storms. It's a long story. I won't describe it. But you have to know, when you read that story, that is more than coincidence. The finger of God was behind the Bible being put into English so that we could become more unleavened. Okay, now we're going to do the offertory. And normally I would go to 1 Corinthians 9, and it says, God blesses those that are generous toward God. But I won't read it. Most of you know the verse. But I just want to ask all of you to, as best you can, give something, put it in the envelope, and I'm going to I'll pass out a few extra envelopes, and I'm going to sit down and pass the envelopes around and give it as you're able. And thank you.